This is Shudders Inc. with Bruce Williams and Glyn Lavender.
Hi, and welcome to episode 291 of Shudders Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuddersIncPodcast.com, and you've just got me this week. Those of you who are on Facebook would know that Glyn has been struck down with a rather severe case of man flu this week. So he is completely out of the picture. So I will just rip through the things that have come up in the week that has gone by. I might actually have a chance to talk some technical stuff now that I don't have Glyn to joke and make snide remarks all the way through it. So we'll see how we go. Things I wanted to cover this week. I had an interesting conversation with one of my workmates on, I think it was Friday of last week. As I'm recording this, it's Easter, well, it's Thursday before Good Friday. But Friday of last week, I was talking to one of my work colleagues, and she mentioned that her mother had a box full of rolls of film that had been exposed, get this, in the late 80s and had never been developed. I could not believe this. And Gabby had some of these images scanned and emailed to herself at work, and she was showing me them. And some of them were seriously light affected. But I just found this whole notion of shooting rolls and rolls of film and then never doing anything with them for 30 years to be just astounding. You know, there were pictures of Gabby, who's now in her 30s, as a young child, like in single digits. It just blew my mind. And like I said, you know, some of these, you know, these rolls of film had obviously not been stored particularly well. I'm assuming they'd not been in a temperature controlled environment. They'd probably been subjected to, you know, fluctuations, you know, between hot weather and cold weather and whatnot, because there were all sorts of, you know, color aberrations to the images, and there were obvious light leaks that had somehow got across some of the images. And I was amazed at that, and wondered if anyone had ever come across any other family who did something like that, because that just strikes me as bizarre. I know, you know, in this digital age, we have a tendency to take photographs and then we slap them on a hard drive and we look at them in Lightroom or Photoshop, and, you know, we might muck around with processing a couple of them, and then there can be a bit of a tendency to just let them sit there on the hard drive and they never get looked at ever again. I try not to fall into that trap. I generally, of everything that I shoot, I find the stuff that I like, and I export it and I throw it on my phone, and I usually, you know, depending on what it is, put a couple up on Facebook so they get seen and they get noticed and whatever. But yeah, this concept of shooting rolls and rolls, like Gab said, there was probably 20 rolls of film that were shot anywhere from the late 80s through to the early 90s, and they haven't been developed. I was like, what? That's just trippy. Anyway, I thought that was bizarre. Anyway, if you've ever heard of anyone else that does something like that, let me know, because I can't imagine there'd be too many people who would do something like that. Anyway, very interesting. Over the last week, I have been thinking, and this, I think this is because of the lunar eclipse, which is occurring this Saturday night, and I know that's going to be past history by the time you hear this podcast. But this Saturday night, Easter Saturday, the 4th of April, there's going to be a what they're calling the shortest lunar eclipse. I don't know if it's on record, but it's certainly a short lunar eclipse. I think the peak of it is going to last for about 4 minutes, from 3 minutes to 11 to 1 minute past 11 on Saturday night, at least. From a Sydney perspective, obviously that will differ depending on where you are. Carl Hemmings sent me a link to Time and Date, I think it's called. Yeah, timeanddate.com, with the link for Melbourne, So if you're in Melbourne and you're wanting to shoot the eclipse on Saturday night, well, it's going to be a bit late for you to hear this, but hopefully you got out and managed to shoot it. I am planning to get out and shoot it, although there is a forecast for rain in Sydney, and Sydney's only an hour's drive south of where I am, so there's a possibility I'm going to have a bit of cloud cover up here on the Central Coast as well. However, David Kembry is coming down from Newcastle. We're going to hook up on Saturday night with the intention of heading down to the coastal area at Terrigal. There's a rock formation called the Skillion, and we're thinking we might head down there. It'll depend on the weather. If it is raining, we'll maybe just stay at my place and try and shoot off the balcony or something like that, where we can at least be undercover. So, yeah, I'm hoping to get some shots of the lunar eclipse. But that whole cycle of thought, if you like, has got me thinking about astrophotography. And I guess, you know, in my travels around the interwebs over the last couple of weeks, I've seen, you know, in various places, images of, you know, these beautiful pitch black skies and the image of the Milky Way, you know, over various landscape visages. And it got me thinking, I'd love to do that. So I've been looking into it. Apparently the best time to shoot the Milky Way is at the new moon. And the new moon is basically when there is no moon, right? So as we go through the lunar cycle, the sliver of the moon that we can see gets smaller and smaller and smaller, until there is an evening where there is no moon at all, because it's, I don't know, on the other side of the Earth, I guess. And then it starts to come back in, and the sliver that we can see gets bigger and bigger each night. So around the new moon is the best time to be shooting the Milky Way, because you're not getting any light pollution from the moon. And as long as you have got yourself out into a nice, you know, dark piece of the landscape away from any ambient light, so far away from a town, then you should be able to get some decent, you know, photographs of the Milky Way. So with that in mind, I have started a group on Facebook and picked the date in the middle of May. I think it's around about the 16th of May, if I'm not mistaken, which is the Saturday night. I think the new moon actually occurs on the 18th. Which is 2 days afterwards. But I have read that, you know, four days either side of the new moon is a reasonable window in which to shoot. A little bit of moonlight is not a bad thing, because it gives a little bit of illumination to the landscape in front of you. So that tends to give you a little bit of detail. And then obviously you can supplement that with artificial light if you so choose. So I thought, as a location, that I might head out to the Warrumbungles, which is a national park here in New South Wales, out near a town called Coonabarabran. For those who don't live in Australia, that probably sounds like a really weird name. We have a lot of places that have weird names like that. A lot of them are derived from Aboriginal languages and words, and it probably has a meaning in one of the Aboriginal tongues, but I have no idea what that meaning is, but Coonabarabran is the nearest town. So myself and a couple other people are going to head out there middle of May and have a crack at shooting the Milky Way during or just before the new moon. So if you're interested in joining us, if you're in New South Wales, or hey, even if you're not and you're prepared to travel, hit me up for a link if you can't find it for yourself. But I have started a group and invited a few people that I thought might be interested in coming along, and yeah, looking forward to it. A couple of portfolios of images that came across my radar through the week that I wanted to share. I mean, I normally share at least one portfolio of images, but there were a couple this week that really grabbed me. One was on lightstalking.com, and this was a portfolio of images that was all about minimalism. And some of these images were just fantastic. Some of them were landscapes, some of them were abstract, some of them were... Well, there was just a whole mixture of images, but definitely worth a look. Some of the water-based images were fantastic, because, you know, the sky and the water all looked like white, and there were just these tiny elements within the image, you know, whether they were fence posts sticking out of the water, or it was a couple of guys in a dinghy sitting out in the middle of the frame. Yeah, just some really good stuff. There was a stop sign that was obviously shot at night with a flash, but you can't see the pole that's holding the stop sign up, so it's just this sea of blackness with a stop sign in the middle. Yeah, some really cool images in there, so go check them out. They'll be in the show notes. The other one was an image or a collection of images of ocean waves, and these are shot by a guy here in New South Wales, down on the south coast. And this was on Petapixel, and he just has this way of capturing these waves that just almost makes them look like solid structures. And just a fantastic collection of images. He mainly shoots right at daybreak. And what's crazy, like on the if you scroll right down on this link, you'll find there's a video that talks or where he talks about his approach to this. And you see this guy diving off rocks straight into like swirling waves that are about to crash onto said rocks, you know, in his wetsuit with fins and holding a bloody massive DSLR in a waterproof housing. Pretty crazy stuff. But some of the images are just amazing. They look like rocks, like weathered rocks, some of them. Because he's captured them at a point where there's no spray coming off some of them, so they just look like these million year old rocks. But anyway, go check them out. They're definitely worth having a look at. Through the week, I did notice that William Long up in Queensland, who has made quite a name for himself, keeping an eye on the rules and regulations associated with various photo competitions. And who does a very good job of outing all those photo competitions that are not particularly photographer friendly. The ones that want to own your work forever and a day and, you know, for use in every media known to man, you know, from here till the end of time. William was awarded through the week the 2015 Queensland Commercial Photographer of the Year. So William, well done, matey. Well done. That's a lovely honour, I am sure. And some of his architectural work is beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So well done, William. There were some great April Fool's pranks, well, in every sphere, audio, photography, tech, you name it, happens every year. A great one that I saw on F-Stop Lounge was new world record for the price paid for a photograph. And of course, this comes hot on the heels of, you know, Peter Lick's Phantom image, which, you know, sold for a record, what was it, $6.5 million or something 3 or 4 months ago. This was a great April Fool's, and it was amazing how many people commented on this and obviously had not read the article, because had they scrolled far enough down the article, they would have seen the, you know, supposed image which had just, you know, attained a new record of $9.3 million for, you know, this single print, and it was called Lens Cap, and it was just a black image. So it was a good one. It was a good story. But yeah, I couldn't believe how many people fell for that and, you know, obviously didn't read enough to get the gag, because if you'd read far enough into the story, it was pretty obvious that it was an April Fool's joke. Something else Carl Hemmings put up on the Shutters Inc. wall through the week on Facebook was a story from digitalcameraworld.com, 32 things photographers say and what they really mean. Again, this is good for a giggle. I won't go into it. You can follow the link, which will be in the show notes. A little bit tongue in cheek, but very, very close to the money in a lot of respects. So, thank you for that link, Carl. He also sent us a link, an email, and he said, "Hi, Bruce and Glenn, here's a behind the scenes on how they made the Eclipse bicycle photo shoot with world famous trial mountain biker Danny Mack, in brackets, not a motor biker, Glenn," with the link. So I'll be honest, Carl, I haven't had a chance to go and have a look at that, but I will do so after I finish recording. Thank you for the link, and that will be in the show notes for those that want to check it out. And he also said, I use this app to turn my iPad into a tablet, astropad.com. I have to concur with David Marlin's email on bucket lists. Enjoy your life now, as you never know what's around the corner. I was diagnosed with mantle cell lymphoma back in 2007. I had stem cell transplant in 2009, body meltdown and a coma in 2011, and touch wood, nothing in the near future. But at the same time, I'm guilty of trying to capture everything of my young 7.5-year-old boy's life on a camera. He keeps on saying, "Dad, no more photos. Maybe I should enjoy life more with my son away from the camera's prism. Anyway, keep up the great podcast." Well, thanks, Carl. Yeah, it's a balancing act, I guess. I don't know. I don't know where I stand on that because I'm in my late 40s now, and if there's one thing I recognize, it's that there are very few photos of me from my life. My parents separated when I was 7. My mum and I left my dad, and my mum didn't get to take any photos with her. Long story. She had organized for stuff to follow us, but that stuff got intercepted by my father, so we never received a lot of what mum had hoped to take with us. So there's not many photos of my childhood. And then through my teens and my 20s, I guess I just wasn't a very social type of guy, and so I was never at parties, so there were never photos of me in social interaction. And, you know, and then into my 30s and my 40s, I've, you know, been the one taking the photos. So there's really not many photos of me from any stage of my life. I mean, there's some, but there's not a lot. I can kind of imagine, you know, that on some hands you want to capture images of your kids, and as you say, at the same time you also want to enjoy life. So, interesting balancing act. Carl also sent us an interesting, well, he tagged Glyn and I in a storm chaser photograph that was published on Facebook through the week. And this was apparently from Victoria, and it was a cracking image. You've got what looks like a bay or an ocean on the left-hand side, a series of four sort of carved wooden totem pole type things, and then a what looks like a concrete path, which follows the edge of the water, and then this beautiful display of forked lightning right across the entire sky. I've got to say, it looks like maybe there's a little bit of HDR in this, because the amount of light on the four poles on the camera side seems like it's just a little bit too well lit, given all of this lightning is occurring off in the distance on the other side of the poles. It's an absolutely cracking image. And apparently the Victorian Storm Chasers, that is the Facebook group, they create a calendar every year, and this calendar is the April image for this year. So I'll put that link in the show notes if anyone wants to check out that image. It's a gorgeous image. What do we get next? From Adam. The photos in North Korea. This was a very interesting story. This guy went to North Korea, and like any of us on holiday, I guess, he just wanted to take photographs. And he somehow ran afoul of the law in North Korea. I don't know whether he was there as a commercial photographer or if he really was just on holiday, but it seems that every photograph he took, the North Koreans took issue with. Either he was depicting poverty, which you're not allowed to do in photographs, either he was photographing the military, which you're not allowed to do, he was photographing children using computers, but there was no power to the computers, and that was forbidden to show that. So it was just all these random things that he'd, you know, things that you would normally take photographs of, I guess, if you were on holiday. And there were all these, you know, missives for him to delete all of these images. Yeah, just bizarre. So anyway, worth a look. Thanks, Adam. Adam also posted a link to an F-Stoppers article, and this was all about the Senate in Arkansas passing a bill to make street photography illegal. So you basically can't walk down the street and take photos. But I think I did see a day or two later that this bill got overturned. I think. But anyway, yeah, crazy stuff. Makes you wonder what sort of a world we're living in if we're going to get to that point where, you know, you're just not allowed to even take a photograph walking down the street. Yeah, anyway, bizarre. Ken Dixon posted an interesting link on the Facebook wall, and this was to rsvlts.com. I'm not sure exactly what that stands for. The Roosevelts. Okay. And this was a great collection of images. And the title of the post is, "Since the 1980s, Jeff Bridges has done something incredible on the set of all his movies." And it turns out that what Jeff Bridges has done is, using a wide lux camera, which looks like it's shooting in a 16:9 format, he's taken all these behind the scenes photographs on the sets of the movies that he's worked on. And there are just some absolutely cracking images here from movies like The Big Lebowski, True Grit, Crazy Heart, Blown Away, Tron Legacy. Yeah, a whole bunch of stuff. And then there's a lot of those get repeated. True Grit again, The Big Lebowski again, Iron Man. Yeah, great collection of images. Some of them he's in. So he's taken them like a selfie at arm's length, and some of them he's obviously, you know, taken a traditional photo and he's not in it, but really interesting collection of images. So, Ken, thank you very much for the link, mate. That's great. Right. Now, I hinted earlier on in the podcast that I was going to get into a bit of a technical discussion. Given Glyn's absence, I can actually get away with it without being trampled over with snide remarks. So, this is something that's been kicking around in my head in the last week or so, and I thought there are a lot of people who probably don't understand bit depth, how that pertains to the capture of digital images and what it really means. And I'm sure there are some people who, you know, absolutely curl up in the fetal position the moment you start talking about this stuff. If you are one of those people, please bear with me, because I want to try and explain this in a way that will make sense. When we talk about the bit depth of an image, right, we talk about JPEG files being an 8-bit image, or, you know, RAW files being a 12-bit image or a 14-bit image, depending on which camera you're shooting with. What we're talking about is the number of places in the word length that make up the storage of the binary data. Let's imagine that all of your information regarding the light coming into your sensor had to be stored with one bit of information, right? Now, in any binary system, you've only got two potential values, a one or a zero. So for one bit of data, there can only be two potential values. If we go to two bits of data, we can have four potential values, because we can have 00, 01, 10, or 11. Okay. And if we then go to a third bit of data, so we now got a number that's 3 units in length, we can have 8 potential values, because it's 2^3. And every time we add one more digit to the length of the binary word, we can double the number of potential values that can represent that one pixel of the image. So if you imagine that the length of the word, right, and word in a data context here, will define how many values we can assign to the luminosity for any given pixel of an image. You understand, right, that you've got a sensor that's made up of however many million pixels, right? The amount of light collected at each one of those pixels can be graphed, if you like, on a scale of its luminosity between pure black and pure white. And how many ways we can describe that value of luminosity is dictated by the word length, right? So if you've only got one bit of data in the word length, then you can only have two values, pure black or pure white, which means your entire image is made up of pixels that are either black or white, and there is no in between. If we go to a two-bit word where we've got four potential values to describe that luminosity, then any single pixel in your image can have one of four potential luminosities between pure black, pure white, and, you know, a couple of gray states in between that. If we then go to a third bit of data, which gives us eight potential values for the luminosity of each pixel, you've now got a black pixel, a white pixel, and six gray intermediate steps. Does that make sense? So the more positions we add to that word length, then the more accurately we can define or describe the luminosity of any given pixel in our image, right? So when we talk about a JPEG being an 8-bit image, what we have got, if you calculate 2 to the power of 8, you come up with 256. And in binary, the first digit is always a combination of zeros, depending on the length of the word, right? So the values for a JPEG image go from 0 to 255, which represents 256 steps, right? We're so used to counting from 1 that it's a little confusing. Now, your eyes probably just went wide because you're thinking, hang on, 0 to 255, that sounds familiar. Absolutely. If you're in Photoshop, you will have noticed in levels, in curves, in some of those adjustment layers, you will see these numbers, 0 to 255, and that's exactly what it refers to. The number of values of luminosity between pure black and pure white when you are working at 8-bit resolution. Now, I'll come back to the JPEG because this is where I'm going with this whole discussion. However, if we're shooting with RAW, where you've got, well, for my camera, my Sony Alpha 850, it shoots 12-bit. So what that means is 2 to the power of 12, right, because the word length is 12 characters long, means that for every pixel in the image, we can define the luminosity down to a scale of 4,096 different values between pure black and pure white. And obviously, the longer the word length gets, then the more accurately we can describe the luminosity for every pixel in the image. With me so far? Cool. Now, at this point, I want to step away from talking about bits and word lengths, and you're probably thankful for that. I want to talk about exposure. Now, we know from our photographic theory that if we increase or decrease our exposure by one stop, we are either doubling or halving the amount of light collected. True? So, if you are shooting an 8-bit format like JPEG, and you shoot one stop underexposed, instead of capturing 8 bits of data, you are essentially capturing 7 bits of data. Because remember, for every bit we add to the word length, we double the number of potential values that can be assigned to the luminosity of each pixel, right? So if you shoot JPEG and you're one stop underexposed, you're essentially shooting at 7-bit resolution. Now, you might think, okay, well, that's not the biggest deal in the world. I can adjust that in Photoshop or Lightroom or Aperture later on. Yeah, you can. From a mathematical point of view, though, instead of mapping the luminosity of every pixel in that image between 0 and 255, you just limited yourself to storing the luminosity value for every pixel in the image to a value of somewhere between 0 and 127, because you've now only got 7 bits of data, because you halved the amount of light that was collected, and therefore we essentially are ignoring that 8th bit of data, which is why so many people talk about exposing to the right. Right, you've heard people say exposed to the right in reference to the histogram on your camera, right? The reason is because that 8th bit of data equates to half of the amount of light that you've collected. So if you're one stop down, you've only collected half of as much light, therefore you might as well have not captured an 8-bit image. You've only collected a 7-bit image. So how does that impact us? Well, when you go into Photoshop and you open up your image, which is shot in JPEG and it's one stop underexposed, and you look at the levels and you go, oh, a little bit under, I'll just bump that up. And what happens to the histogram in Photoshop? Instead of being a smooth mountain, it ends up as a series of spikes. You've noticed this, yeah? Why is that happening? Because you just took a range of luminosity values from 0 to 127, and you remapped them to a range of 0 to 255. So everything that was at 0 got shifted to 1. Everything that was at 1 got shifted to 2. Everything that was at 2 got shifted to 4. So now your new image has no pixels with a value of 3. Everything that was a 3 got shifted to 6. So now there are no pixels in your new image which have a value of 5. Right. Everything that was a 4 got shifted to an 8, so now there are no pixels in your image with a value of 7. Everything that was a 5 got shifted to 10, so now there are no pixels with a value of 9. You can see where this is going, right? And obviously the further up the scale you go, the bigger the gaps get, right? And we all know that, you know, our ocular system, our eyes, is much more sensitive to bright areas of an image than it is to dark areas of an image. And as we go further up the scale into the brighter pixels within our image, the gaps actually get bigger. And this is why you've sometimes seen JPEGs with really nasty banding artifacts, where there isn't a smooth tonality between pixels of a similar color. There's like this sharp cutoff. And it's because the image has been remapped and there are these massive holes in the luminosity values between certain pixels. So I hope that makes sense, that nailing exposure, particularly if you're going to shoot at 8-bit, is absolutely critical. And I would suggest that, if anything, err on the side of being, you know, a half stop overexposed rather than underexposed, right? Because it's much easier to shift downward. Right, and JPEG will generally survive a half stop of overexposure without being really nastily clipped. There will be some clipping, but it's probably preferable to have a couple of pixels that are clipped than it would be to have this nasty banding artifact that you get when you have to raise the exposure of a JPEG after the fact. And so we come back to the whole shooting RAW thing. You know, when you're shooting with RAW, even if it is only at 12-bit, if you're a stop under, it's really not the end of the world, because you've still captured an 11-bit image, which means that there is enough room to adjust the exposure and remap it to an 8-bit file and not get that nasty banding. That's obviously up to each and every individual photographer to decide whether or not you want to shoot RAW or whether you want to shoot JPEG. Some people like the convenience of JPEG. Yeah, you just shoot it in one format and you can pretty much throw it around the web willy-nilly as you see fit without having to do anything to it. Shooting RAW obviously requires more work, because you have to then post-process, decide what output size you want and what resolution and yada, 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 yada. Personally, as someone who loves landscape photography, I love shooting RAW because it gives me more leeway with exposure. People who've listened to this podcast for a while know that I love shooting multi-image panoramas. And quite often when you're trying to shoot those panoramas, you find that there is a massive exposure difference between the light at one end of your panorama and the light at the other end of the panorama. So generally what I'll do is I'll look for the brightest end, set it for a half to a full stop overexposed, and because I'm shooting manual exposure, I'll then shoot my entire sequence. And even though I might be one stop over at the bright end, it's quite possible that I'll be one stop under by the time I get to the other end of the panorama. The beauty of shooting with RAW, though, is that I can recapture all that tonal range in Lightroom, because I know from experience with my own camera, I can easily shoot a stop over in RAW and not clip any data. I don't know if it's the camera itself or if that's just the way RAW is across all cameras, but I know I can shoot a stop over and be safe. But it just gives me that extra flexibility when I get to the dark end of the sweep. You know, instead of being two stops under, I'm only one stop under. Anyway, I hope that made sense to everybody. Technical, yes, but hopefully it's brought into a little bit of clarity for you what bit depth means in relation to the way images are stored in a digital format. If you've got questions, please sing out. You know, if I can explain it in another way or if I can clarify some minor part of that, I will absolutely attempt to do so. And be thankful that Glenn wasn't here and you'd have been listening to jokes about train engines. All right. Hopefully Glenn will be back on deck next week. And for those who observe such things, have a great Easter. And we'll talk to you next week. Cheers.
Shutters Inc., another audio2you.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out shuttersincpodcast.com or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@shuttersincpodcast.com.